This podcast was researched by members of Fenians, Fremantle and Freedom Group, with assistance from the Immigrant Support Programme of the Irish Government. It was recorded on Whadjuk, Noongar land. We acknowledge the First Nations people of the land we walk upon. We thank you and your ancestors for together sharing in our stories.
This podcast and the others in this series tell a story. A story of 62 brave men, taken in chains from their homeland, Ireland, for fighting to free themselves and their country from a foreign ruler, the British Crown. This story takes us on an incredible journey from Ireland to Australia to the United States and beyond. It's a story of pain, suffering, courage and grit. But above all, it's a story of hope. And what if I was to tell you that this story so happens to be true? Come along. Let me tell you of the Fenian 62.
The 89-day voyage of the Hougoumont, the last convict ship to Australia, had come to an end. She lay at anchor off the coast of Fremantle, as first the passengers, and later the prisoners, were transported by barge to a rudimentary jetty. Early on the morning of the 10th of January, 1868, the final group, the Irish Fenian political prisoners, were put ashore, issued with convict uniforms, and then marched up the hill to the infamous Imperial Convict Establishment, Fremantle Prison. Fenian Robert Wall from County Louth described the scene in a letter home to his mother and father.
Very early on the morning of the 10th of January, we were put on shore in Fremantle and marched through the little town to our destination, the prison. Dressed in a suit of drogheda linen, ornamented with a red stripe and black bands, typical of the rank we hold in the colony, to wit, convicts.
There were 62 Fenians transported to Western Australia. 17 military men, those who had served in the British Army, were sentenced to prison for 20 years, and 45 civilians, whose sentence ranged from 5 to 20 years. If the Fenians thought they were in for an easy time after their arrival, or anything approaching the semi-liberty which other prisoners had enjoyed in Van Diemen's Land 18 years earlier, they were in for a rude awakening. Rules at Fremantle Prison were harsh. There was a long list of offences, the penalty for which was death. County Clare man, civilian Fenian, Thomas Fennell wrote about the Fremantle Prison.
The slam of the massive doors as they closed behind ominously reverberate through the empty halls and corridors, and pierce the culprits with a peculiar thrill of horror that ever after keeps company with their troubled souls. The cells are 7 by 3.5 by 9 feet high, and are lit from without by one small window that nae more than admits the light, the glass being so thickly hammered that transparency and reflections are equally dull. It is protected by iron bars set in lead at both ends in the solid masonry. Floors and ceilings are made from red native mahogany. Reflection from the hammered glass window of cells and skylights show the banisters, bridges, railings and the silver landings, one above the other running parallel at both sides of the great hall. At the base of each tier of cells are black painted corrugated iron doors, thickly set as if intended as an ornament to the dingy whitewash walls.
The decision to transport the men, taken by the British government with minimal consultation with authorities in Western Australia, contributed to Fenian fear in the Swan River colony. Fremantle citizens believed that Irish supporters from America were planning to mount a raid and release not only the Fenian prisoners, but all convicts from Fremantle Prison. Stories spread about the havoc it would cause in the colony should the Fenians be rescued. The fact that Captain Cousins of the Hougoumont wrote a glowing reference to the local paper describing the Fenian behaviour as exemplary from the beginning of the journey to end, and saying he found these particular people to be most civil, obedient and religious, failed to impress the colonists. In a gesture of reassurance, the government ordered a gunboat, HMS Brisk, to Fremantle. Its arrival on the 2nd of February only heightened the level of alarm and fear when the nighttime gunnery practice on the Brisk was mistaken for the anticipated American raid panic spread. Things only quietened down once the Brits departed, a month later.
The penal convict system, which had been operating in Australian colonies for nearly a century, was orderly and prescribed. Prisoners moved through different stages during their sentence. The first 6 months was solitary confinement, with each of the civilian and military Fenians had already served in British prisons. By the time they arrived in Fremantle, the civilian prisoners were eligible for the probation involving supervision labour part of their sentence.
Two of the civilians, journalist John Flood and law clerk Dennis Cashman, together with one of the military Fenians, the poet John Boyle O'Reilly, were employed as clerks within the prison. Within a month, O'Reilly was transferred south to Bunbury. The other military Fenians who were considered army deserters experienced more official hostility and were scattered within the work parties of common criminals. It was one of the most painful features of their sentence. The remainder of the civilians were sent in separate work parties made up entirely of fellow Fenians, which they were viewed as concession, as they were not associating with the criminals. The first Fenian work party, under Warder McGarry, was sent to Bush at Guildford, northeast of Perth, where they laboured quarrying clay and stone. The convicts, the warders, and the warder's family all lived together in very basic conditions. A letter sent by Corkman, John Sarsfield Casey, to his parents revealed the experience.
West Guildford, 31st of January, 1868. The party in which I am is stationed in the bush on the banks of the Swan River, about a mile from the small village of Guildford and 20 miles from Fremantle. Our work is digging and rolling clay and blasting rocks in a quarry from 5:30 in the morning till 6 at night, with the exception of mealtimes. We spend the night in a miserable hut composed of rushes, withered branches of trees, where sleep is almost impossible, in consequence of the continual buzzing and stinging of those troublesome mosquitoes. Their bite raises a blister on the body of such a nature that you are forced to continually scratch it, almost tearing the skin off. Fleas and bugs are as numerous, so that between them all, our bodies are one sore from head to foot. You can form no idea whatever of the heat of the sun here, and it is that principally which makes the work so hard for us. From morning till night, our bodies are bathed in a flood of perspiration, and during the greater part of the day, working without protection from the fierce rays of an almost tropical sun, it is as much as we can do to raise a shovel full of clay or roll a barrow. I have no hesitation in saying that, should my present position continue much longer, I have but very little hope of ever seeing you again.
Despite their cruel conditions, the Fenians remained buoyant. This was largely because of the sympathy and support they received from the region's Irish settlers. Sunday Mass at Guildford Church was an occasion for settlers to pass information about current events, give tobacco to the prisoners and, in time, to post letters for the Fenians who wanted to evade official censorship. The skeleton notes of day-to-day activities kept during 1868 and 69 by John Sarsfield Casey give us an understanding of the Fenians' experience in Western Australia. He recorded that all members of the group struggled under the stresses of their situation, and some feared they would go mad. His notes tell of the resentment felt towards the supervising constables, who were excessively strict taskmasters. A second group of Fenians worked 5 miles away, in another part of Guildford. That group were supervised by Warder Howard, who, like McGarry, had accompanied the Fenians on the Hougoumont. Howard's behaviour was both brutal and terrifying. For this group, time dragged. Tensions between the Fenians and Warder Howard built. Suspicions were held that Howard had embezzled money, which had been allocated as a clothing allowance for the convicts. Relations were further strained at the beginning of February 1869, when the Fenians sided with Howard's wife after she objected to a prostitute visiting her husband in camp. When Howard charged one of the Fenians, David Cummins from Cork, with insolence, the entire group protested and refused to work. Brophy, Kelly, Moore, and Sheehan were considered to be the ringleaders, and together with 10 other Fenians were returned to Fremantle Prison to serve a period of solitary confinement on bread and water. This became known as the Guildford Mutiny. It was actually a united demonstration of civil disobedience. With no physical violence, but in a convict system, there was no opportunity to appeal for justice. After their time in solitary in Fremantle Prison, the Fenians who were previously in Howard's party were dispersed to different work groups, and Warder Howard was transferred 120 miles south to Bunbury. Let's hear from a descendant of one of these men, Anne Golden, a Kerry woman now living in Western Australia.
My great-granduncle, John Golden from Kerry, took part in the so-called Guildford Mutiny. When he was released from solitary, he found out that he and four of his companions were to be sent to Bunbury. His previous reports all described him as being of good character, but the possibility of remaining in Warder Howard's party was obviously too much. When they arrived in Bunbury on the 17th of February 1869, John Golden and his four Fenian companions were sentenced to 7 days on bread and water for refusing to be separated from each other. When released on the 25th of February, they continued their protest and were again sentenced to 7 days on bread and water. Their strength and solidarity was such that each time their 7 days was up, they stood firm in their refusal and were immediately sentenced to another 7 days of the same inhumane treatment. Finally, on the 27th of March, after 6 weeks on bread and water, these five men achieved some form of moral victory when the Bunbury authorities returned them to Fremantle Prison for indefinite solitary confinement. Perhaps their resolve had been strengthened by the whispers around the Bunbury prison about the dramatic escape of their charismatic fellow Fenian, the poet John Boyle O'Reilly, who is the subject of another podcast in this series. On the 18th of February 1869, O'Reilly absconded from a work party near Bunbury. Despite extensive searching, he was never relocated. In fact, through the generous support of a local priest, Father Patrick McCabe, and the courageous assistance of local Irish settlers, he escaped on an American whaling ship, the Gazelle, and lived out the remainder of his life as a journalist and newspaper editor in Boston. Unlike Golden, others working under Warder Howard, some of Warder McGarry's civilian Fenians, obtained their ticket of leave, which permitted them to seek outside employment. Skilled workers were difficult to find in the Swan River colony. Many of the Fenians were well educated, so their services were in demand. John Sarsfield Casey was employed as a schoolmaster by Father Patrick Gibney in the inland town of York. His skills and ability impressed both the priest and a local school inspector. Casey also became the York reporter for the Fremantle Herald, and as he spoke Spanish, was called on to translate religious ceremonies for the monks at the New Norcia Monastery. Some members of the Catholic clergy assisted the Fenians, supporting networks of communication which even reached the military Fenians, who were the most tightly guarded. Casey became a key participant in these networks. He wrote letters which were smuggled out and published in progressive British and Irish newspapers, highlighting the unjust treatment of Fenian political prisoners. He carried the expectations of both the military and civilian Fenians to source newspapers from Ireland, procure writing paper and stamps, and write letters about their conditions.
Meanwhile, in Ireland, England and the eastern colonies of Australia, far away from the isolation of Western Australia, an amnesty movement was underway to support the Fenians, raise money and eventually pay their passage back to Ireland or to the USA. The Fenian amnesty movement dated back to the time of the first arrests in Ireland, when a ladies' committee formed, drawn primarily from the wives and relatives of prominent prisoners. They held fundraising events and sent representatives around Ireland to support prisoners' families. Members also acted as contacts with sympathisers and formed networks of prominent publicists in European countries to draw attention to the prisoners' condition. This letter, sent from schoolmaster Casey in York, Western Australia, to his cousin Kate in Cork, Ireland, is a rare personal narrative that highlights how Irish women supported the Fenian cause.
My dear cousin, this is a letter sent to the Irishman newspaper last September. If it did not appear, send this letter to my brother Dan in America and tell him to get it printed in one of the American papers. The only chance we have of getting free again is by exposing the cruel treatment inflicted on us. My dear cousin, I have a secret for you. Mind, you must tell no one, for your life, not even my father or mother. It is this. The pay I am receiving in this poor place will never keep me in clothes and support me. Besides, I cannot get the money out of these people. Now, I cannot get another place and I could not do farm work. So if the people don't support the schoolmaster properly, I must leave and go to prison till the remainder of my sentence shall have expired. There is no other chance for me. I can get no other employment. Now, I know you are all off at home, but still you must try and send me a few pounds. I know you haven't it yourself, but some of my old friends will, I'm sure. If I left this miserable country, I would be able to pay you in a short time. There is very little circulation of money here. Debts are mostly paid in stores, tea, sugar, wheat. This has been a fearfully bad week. The whole country is covered in thick smoke from the innumerable bushfires. The sun appears a red ball. Butter is like water. Water all hot, all wells mostly dry. Winds burning hot and thousands of acres on fire. Wheat, corn, houses, horses burnt down in all directions. We all expect a pardon soon. If so, I shall go home if I can make up a passage money. If not, I will go to Sydney or Queensland, as we would not be allowed to land in any of the other colonies. Let me know, are any of the men in England out yet? Send me a few papers. Keep this private and try to do what I ask of you. At all events, write immediately.
As time went on, a much wider group of liberals, nationalists, and reformers campaigned for fair treatment for those arrested. In Britain, Fenianism itself highlighted the anomaly of Ireland in relation to Britain's self-image as a liberal state, especially when prominent people in Britain, such as Jenny Longuet, the daughter of Karl Marx, supported their cause. This pressure resulted in the British government on 15th of May 1869 announcing free pardons for 34 of the Australian-based Fenian prisoners, including schoolmaster Casey in York, prison clerk Dennis Cashman, and John Golden, who had been returned to Fremantle Prison from Bunbury.
Soon after the free pardon was granted, civilian Fenian John Keneally, who had been one of the best organisers of the movement back in Ireland, was the obvious choice to send from Fremantle to the eastern states to make arrangements for their departure from Australia. Despite being a free man, Keneally risked arrest in Melbourne, where former convicts were prevented from landing. In Sydney, he collected the money raised by Irish supporters in the eastern colonies and arranged to access the funds which had been collected back in Ireland, and he made the necessary arrangements for the released men to travel to Sydney and from there take ships to Ireland or to the USA. Not all the civilian Fenians were given a pardon. Former Dublin builders Hugh Francis Brophy and Joseph Noonan had set up a business in Perth and were employing a number of ticket of leave men. It was a further 3 years before they gained permission to leave. During that time, they constructed a number of civic and church buildings throughout Perth, including the Mercy Convent and the Perth Town Hall. On Saturday, 11th of September, 1869, 25 of the pardoned civilian Fenians prepared to leave Perth for King George Sound, Albany, the only port in the colony where a passenger ship departed.
John Sarsfield Casey wrote, "On that morning, crowds collected to witness the procession forming, which was soon to drive triumphantly through the streets of the loyal city of Perth. First came the splendid cavalcade of ladies and gentlemen on horseback, mustering 25 or 30, the gay costumes of the former forming a striking contrast to the more homely attire of the latter. Next came the coach containing the departing exiles, drawn by four horses. At the rear were several carriages, crowded with friends and sympathisers. In this manner, we travelled through the principal thoroughfares, by the Government House, over the immense bridge across the Swan. None halted until the whole company reached a wayside inn, some 20 miles from Perth, where an excellent dinner having been prepared, to which justice was done, and several Sinn Féins to celebrate the final farewell between men who, from Mountjoy to Portland to Western Australia, had loved and toiled and suffered together in one sacred cause. The company separated, one portion for Perth, the other to commence a journey of 20,000 miles before their eyes could again behold the green hills of old Ireland. The road to the Sounds, constructed, as are all public works in the colony, by convict labour, often merged into a mere beaten track, winding through the immense barren country, clothed with gigantic gums, interspersed at intervals with extensive sand plains. At night, our camp was pitched under the deep shadow of the forest, huge trunks growing all around us. The magnificent vault of heaven, studded with brilliant stars, scattered like glittering gold dust, our only canopy. Saturday, 20th of September. Some 20 miles from Albany, we caught a glimpse of the wild waves of the Southern Ocean. Fatigued and weary after 10 days' journey through the wild and cheerless country, the sight of the off-white crested waves was cheering to our sight.
Keneally had returned from Sydney and was in Albany to meet his weary Fenian companions and smooth out the final administrative hurdles for their departure.
John Sarsfield Casey wrote, Albany, Western Australia, 21st of September, 1869. Everything being satisfactorily arranged, we went on board the Rangitara and steamed swiftly along through the dark, wild waves of the Southern Ocean, bound for Sydney via Adelaide and Melbourne. Within 4 days, we sighted the first light on Kangaroo Island. The glorious orb of the day poured down its burning rays from the sky, as blue as that which overshadows the classic land of Italy. At 9 o'clock, we arrived opposite the small village of Glenelg, where we hove to, awaiting the rising of the tide. Here we were boarded by a detective who, the moment he learned that 25 of the notorious Fenians were aboard, telegraphed the same to Adelaide. We told him we would neither give our names nor produce our papers, as we had no intention of landing in South Australia and did not recognise his right to question us. The steamer was surrounded by several boats filled with genuine Irishmen who came on board, burning with impatience to welcome us with the Cade Mila Fáilte to the shores of South Australia. At Port Adelaide, an exciting scene presented itself to our view. The quays, extensive as they are, were crowded almost to suffocation with people, resembling one dark sea of human faces. The aspect relieved here and there by the gay, and in many instances, gaudy costume of the fair sex. Not a window or a balcony, but was absolutely filled with spectators anxious to jump on board. Then commenced such a scene as those who witnessed it will not forget for some time. The grasping of hands lasted until our arms were nearly dislocated. Many venerable men and women, grey with tears, were moved to tears. So overjoyed were they at speaking to the despised felons of 65 and 67. During our stay of 4 days in Adelaide, from dawn to midnight, the steamer was crowded with Ardenan sympathisers who neglected business to honour the released prisoners and the cause which they represented. All this time, the vessel was closely guarded by policemen, no doubt with the intention of arresting us, should we dare to pollute the immaculate soil of South Australia with our unhallowed footsteps. Surely no greater proof can be required of the universal hatred entertained by Irishmen in all parts of the world towards the government of England than this grand reception of released prisoners.
On the 6th of October, 1869, the Rangatira arrived in Sydney, where the Irish community of New South Wales showed overwhelming kindness and enthusiasm towards the released Fenians. As news of their arrival spread throughout the city, huge crowds gathered outside their hotel, blocking streets and thoroughfares. Irish residents vied with each other to have, even for the single night, one of the Fenian as a guest of their home.
Casey wrote, "An Irish family deemed it a far greater honour to receive and entertain one of us at their homes than if the Queen's representative condescended to visit them."
The night before they departed, a large banquet was held in their honour. On the 21st of October, 15 of the released prisoners, including Dennis Cashman, embarked on board the Beringa, en route to California, the country of their adoption. It was an emotional separation for these tough Fenian men. One group were leaving to sail east to San Francisco, and the others sailed south to Melbourne to join the Suffolk, which would take them to England and from there home to Ireland. The final parting between the released prisoners was touching in the extreme. Men who during 4 long and painful years had worked, lived and suffered together from Dublin's notorious Mountjoy Jail to Portland Prison, where they had defied their English jailers. From the holds of the convict ship Hougoumont to Western Australia, they who had endured the extremes of heat and cold, hunger and thirst, were now shedding tears. Through excesses of grief and with extraordinary difficulty, they tore themselves from each other's embrace.
Let Erin remember the days of old, her faithless sons be.
Casey wrote, "Until the vessel faded in the horizon blue, many an anxious eye, dim with tears, gazed with sorrow on the retreating form. Deep and fervent prayers were offered for a steady breeze to carry them safely to the shores of that El Dorado."
John Sarsfield's Casey returned to Ireland, where he continued to write and to advocate on the rights of the tenant farmers in the Galtee Mountains. He remained in touch with other prominent Fenians, including John Devoy and poet John Boyle O'Reilly. His writings remained with his family and were later published in 2 books, The Galtee Boy and The Mingling of Swans. Dennis Cashman sailed on the Beringa to San Francisco, and from there travelled to Boston, where he worked with John Boyle O'Reilly on the Boston Pilot newspaper. In the USA, he was reunited with his beloved Kate and their children. His papers were donated to the East Carolina University in 1982 and published as Fenian Diary by Professor C.W. Sullivan. Five Fenians, including John Golden, John Flood, and Edward Kelly, depart Fremantle for New Zealand in May 1871, but were denied entry and sailed to Sydney. Edward Kelly remained in Sydney, organising the Irish Republican Brotherhood, as well as collecting funds to assist the military Fenians who were left behind in Fremantle Prison. He departed for San Francisco in 1876, only months before the famous Catalpa escape, and settled in Boston. John Golden moved to Gerringong, south of Sydney, where he worked as a carpenter, and he and his wife Ellen had seven children. John Flood moved to the gold mining town of Gympie in Queensland, where he became a prominent citizen, justice of the peace, and the editor of the Gympie Miner newspaper. He married Susan O'Byrne and had four children and remained active in Irish affairs. He retained all seven editions of the original handwritten The Wild Goose newspaper, which the Fenians produced while on board the Hougoumont. They were passed to his daughter, Rosalie, a Loretta nun, and then on to her niece, who presented the collection, together with a copy of his pardon to the State Library of New South Wales in 1968, exactly 100 years after they landed in Fremantle with the Fenians. Hugh Brophy continued his work as a builder in Perth and later in Melbourne, where he lived a long life and remained active in Irish political affairs.
The military Fenians were never released from their 20-year sentence. They remained prisoners in Western Australia until 1876. They were not forgotten by their companions, many of whom, including O'Reilly, Cashman and Kelly, worked for years to raise funds for their rescue. In 1871, former Fenian commander John Devoy was released from prison in Britain and given permission to travel to the USA, on condition that he never returned to Ireland. On hearing this, James Wilson, still in prison in Fremantle, wrote a letter titled Voices from the Tomb, begging him to find a way to help the military prisoners escape. Devoy, a brilliant and well-respected tactician, explored every possibility. By March 1875, they had enough money and a plan. He arranged the purchase of a whaling ship, the Catalpa. An elaborate plot was hatched by a brave ship's captain, George Smith Anthony, sailed from New Bedford in the USA to Western Australia and stole those brave Fenians away. This story is the subject of another podcast.
In this podcast, we've highlighted the lives of a few of the 62 Irish political prisoners, the Fenians, transported to Australia on the last convict ship, the Hougoumont. There are many more stories to uncover and share. The legacy of these brave and patriotic men lives on in Australia, in Ireland, and in the USA. Their courage in the face of adversity, their dedication to the Irish cause, their love of culture and country, and their support for each other is as relevant today as it was 150 years ago.
Let Erin remember the days of old, her faithless sons betrayed her, when Malahi wore the collar of gold, which he won from her proud invader, when her kings with standard of greens unfurled, let the red brine's knights to danger, ere the emerald green of the western world was set in the crown of a stranger.
Production of this podcast series was supported by the Government of Ireland's Immigrant Support Programme. Historical research and writing by Peter Murphy and Margot O'Byrne. Narrated by Jennifer McGrath, John McCarthy and Dr. Daryl Milo. Music performed and recorded by John Clare, Kieran O'Sullivan and John Reid. Recorded at Wits End Studios, Fremantle, Western Australia. Technical production by Alan Dawson. Post-production by Josephine Hayes On behalf of Fenians, Fremantle and Freedom, we thank all those who participated in the series and for their ongoing support.